Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 152, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 30th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we conclude our two-month journey with Coriolanus. We're going to discuss a directorial concept and a cast, a conclusion and a wrap-up. Oh, and two, count them, two bits of shameless self-promotion. Okay, so a concept. Fiennes did such an incredible job bringing the play into the modern day. I think there's some merit to that. Only, I don't want to be typically Eurocentric, so I'm wondering if an African setting might not work. Somalia could stand in for Rome, and Puntland, a Somali breakaway state for which piracy is an actual economic staple, could be the basis for the Volscians. I remember the RSC Julius Caesar from a couple of years back using colonized African vocal rhythms to great effect, making the Shakespearean verse sound pretty natural, and I think the same may work here. As for the set, I see a mixture of classical Roman ruins and modern war-torn disheveled. Maybe even some of the more ruinous elements could be conspicuously painted over to cover the past. Why? Because I kind of see a post-colonial concept here. There's an influence of Western culture and architecture, but also an expressed attempt to move beyond that. Of course, with that comes dangers of its own. I see Rome, Somalia, militarized for sure, but it's also in a state of flux. The citizenry, I think, I might stage as being obviously Muslim, possibly fundamentalist, a threat to the status quo, both to the non-fundamentalist blacks and obviously the non-blacks as well. And so we've got the setting and the set. Now what about the actors? Well, as I mentioned, I see this as a post-colonial reading of the play, and thus Menenius, our patrician, I would cast as white. And in that role, I see Willem Dafoe. Dafoe's got a wide-ranging career with Platoon and Shadow of the Vampire to his credit, and also Streets of Fire. Not Shakespeare, I know, but it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. Anyway, his appearance is unusual. He gives off a sense of the other, of not quite being where he belongs. Perfect for a patrician in this war-torn African country. As Marcius's wife, Virgilia, I see 39-year-old Danai Gurira. She's a great actress, widely known for her role as Michonne in The Walking Dead. I hate to waste such a talented actress on such a thankless role, but somebody's got to do it. The put-upon wife ain't gonna play herself. As Marcius, I see Chadwick Boseman. He's played Jackie Robinson in the film 42, James Brown in Get On Up, and is Black Panther in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so range is not an issue. In fact, here's a case where the actor may have way too much range for the role. At 40, he looks younger than he is, and I do want to play up his youth, both in his determination to prove himself and as his mother's baby. He also has this quiet quality, almost aloof, that I see could be seen as arrogance. As his foil, Ophidius, I want someone as similar to Marcius as possible, and I've decided upon David Oyelowo. At 41, he's close to Boseman's age, but he looks slightly more weathered. He, too, can play quiet strength, as in the film Selma, where he played Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But I first saw him in the British TV series M5, where he displayed a wit and a charm that can also be put to use here. A plus is his Shakespeare stage background, having played Othello to Daniel Craig's Iago a few years back. And now, for the role I've wrestled over. Marcius's mother has got to be of a certain age, shall we say. And I want that age to show, but not his decrepitness, but his mileage, experience. I still want a strength to her. Now, if I wanted to go the regal, formal route, as Fiennes did, I would have gone with Felicia Rashad. She has this elegance to her. But I want something a bit tougher, someone obviously more dangerous. And here, I'm going to use the audience's perception of the actor's past roles to fill in that toughness blank. As Volumnia, I see Pam Grier. At 67, she's got the mileage, but we know her best from the blaxploitation films of the 70s and her career renaissance in Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. This is no woman to be trifled with, whether you're her general son or some bureaucrat that just stabbed said son in the back. Vermeer Greer just kind of personifies strength. And so, that's my concept and cast. Do you have one you'd like to share? Well, if you do, drop it into the comment thread of this podcast's blog post. Shakespeare fans, need a poster to hang in your room? Teachers, need some nifty handouts for your students to peruse as you introduce them to the Bard? Or are you just in the mood for some printable versions of some of the cool infographics found on this website? Well, regardless of how you answered those questions, I've got a scratch for that itch, a solution for that problem. Check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the Teachers Pay Teachers website. You can find character maps for Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar previewing the characters and their relationships to one another. I've also got geographical maps so your students can wrap their heads around travels within the plays Troilus and Cressida. Yes, even TNC gets some love. All's Well That Ends Well as well. See what I did there? Plus Pericles and Othello. There's also handouts on the so-called history in Macbeth and Julius Caesar, time in Romeo and Juliet, and violence in Titus Andronicus. Also, you'll find entire packets of handouts for both King Lear and Macbeth, including scene-by-scene timelines and the interactions as well as relationships between the characters. And I'll be adding even more soon. Plus, this is where you can find the printable version of the new and improved periodic table of Shakespeare. Some of these are for free, and some are for purchase, but all can be found on the Bill Shakespeare Project page on teacherspayteachers.com. Oh, and if you want to purchase a pre-printed poster-sized version of that periodic table, well then head on over to the Bill Shakespeare Project page on redbubble.com. Links to both of these sites can be found in the left-hand margin of this website. So, Coriolanus. This is a strange play. Intense, political, intensely political, but it's a tragedy. There's no way around it. But is Marcius a tragic hero? Now, way back when, just after we started this project, we read Titus Andronicus, and we kind of asked the same very question of that play as well. And I called that play a play of revenge, a horror show. That was Shakespeare's first tragedy, and this, Coriolanus, is the last. Tragedy. Now, according to our old friend Aristotle, the tragic hero is subjected to a reversal of fortune, almost always from good to bad. This reversal is supposed to create fear and pity in the audience, finally resulting in a catharsis, a release of emotions, an emotional cleansing. Again, according to Aristotle, the reversal of fortune is caused by the central character's harmatia. Now, many have incorrectly translated this as tragic flaw, as if it was some kind of character flaw or personality defect that causes the downfall. But technically, this is incorrect. Hamartia is an error in judgment. It comes from hamar ten ian, which was the situation of an archer missing his target. So really, it's more like the character is trying to achieve his goal, but a mistake carries his downfall. Aristotle also posits that the tragic hero should achieve some kind of anagnorisis, or recognition or revelation about his situation and his position in the world or universe, or sometimes just between himself and his antagonist. Well, for Titus back then, we had reversal of fortune. He enters a powerful general, a candidate for emperor, only to become, by the end, a powerless, outcast, and possibly even deranged civilian. Once a father of 25 sons and a daughter, he is, in his final breath, a man with only one living, though banished, child. Hamartia. Titus sends Alarbus to his doom, despite the fact that anyone would be moved to, if not to call off the sacrifice altogether, then at least to choose another martyr. Aaron, please, can it be Aaron? Anagnorisis. None. He just goes, inextricably, unalterably, toward his own demise. Now, what about our Roman general this time around? Marcius enters the play, a powerful general, one whom we see show his prowess on the field of battle. capturing Coriolis, and coming close to becoming consul, only to become, by the end, an outcast, a traitor to his nation, and one who is killed by what he thought were his new friends. So, reversal of fortune? Check. Is there an error in judgment? Not really. Maybe a string of them, culminating in his abandonment of Rome. But really, in this case, I think we're actually closer to the incorrect translation of tragic flaw here. Marcius's pride, arrogance, and unforgiving snobbery are what do him in. And what about anagnorisis, that recognition revelation? Well, if the turning away, casting aside of Rome is his harmatia, then possibly he does. When he finally capitulates to Volumnia in Act 5, Scene 2, that and the speech that follows could, I suppose, be seen as a recognition of his error. But it still feels like a bit of a stretch. So tragic? Sure. But a tragic hero? Jeez, I don't know. And he's so unpleasant. Of course, Macbeth's not exactly a bowl of cherries, but somehow the Scot feels more tragic. But maybe that's because he doesn't turn into a total a-hole until after the murder, and Marcius is pretty much a jerk from the beginning. So, in the end, I'm as conflicted about this play as I am about its hero. I love some of the speeches, hate the structure. Then again, I'm intrigued by the structure, but hate the use of women. But I love Volumnia. The people in the play irritate the hell out of me with their unforgiving nature, a perfect foil for Marcius, and their ease of manipulation. But I like what the play has to say about deceit in politics, very Julius Caesar-like in that respect. I like the possible Marxist interpretation, as well as the psychology behind Volumnia's, heck, her whole society's, love of wounds and scars. Now, unlike some other plays, I don't find this one more fascinating than frustrating. Now, this is more like a recent play, Antony and Cleopatra, more frustrating than fascinating, but here only barely so. So, where do I put it? Well, as you can tell from my last statement, I rank it ahead of Antony and Cleopatra in the tragedies. But that's a pretty damn low bar. That's my least favorite tragedy. It's a toss-up for me for seventh place of the tragedies between this and another of its Roman play brethren, Julius Caesar. In fact, I'm going to give Coriolanus the edge by the thinnest of margins. So, in the end, I see it in the lowest third of the tragedies, but it's still in the upper half of all the plays. It's just not a great or fun reading experience. That said, I can't wait to see this done on a stage, though, because I think it could be very, very cool. Almost exactly 1 year ago, I posted an infographic, The Periodic Table of Shakespeare. And at that time, I summed it up thus. There are so many plays, some obvious collaborations, the two noble kinsmen and the like, some lost the time, Love's Labor's Won, those pesky problem plays, a distinction that I'm growing less and less fond of, and stuff that isn't theatrical at all. Plus, I wanted to layer over some kind of historical progression of his writing. We don't know the actual chronology of composition, but we have some rough ideas. That was a year ago, and thus, the periodic table of Shakespeare was born. But time passes. New information arrives, like the new Oxford Shakespeare Authorship Companion, and that got me thinking, and then designing. And thus now, the periodic table of Shakespeare version 2. So, what's changed? Based on the new Oxford, I've jettisoned Double Falsehood, as it now seems more of an adaptation of Cardino, and Edmund Ironside. I've also included, for the first time, Arden of Faversham, the Spanish tragedy, the tragedy of Sejanus, and the poem The Passionate Pilgrim. And I don't even know why I didn't include that last one last time around. I've noted which plays are what we can call primary collaborations. In other words, those plays for which Shakespeare was the primary writer, and those that then also include the work of others. For example, much was made last fall when Marlowe was now given co-writer credit on the Henry VI plays, but more on that in a minute. These plays, as well as the solo compositions, are what we normally call Shakespeare. But then there are others, ones we'll call secondary collaborations. These are the works that are primarily the literary creation of other writers, but to which Shakespeare, it seems, contributed. The first part of Henry VI is one of these plays. Although we look at one Henry VI as Shakespeare, it turns out that Marlowe did the heavy lifting on that one. So this is a category where some of the usual suspects appear, like Two Noble Kinsmen, Henry VIII, and the like, along with some of the unusual suspects, Sir Thomas More, Arden, Cardino, and the like. And based upon this new information, I've shuffled the configuration around a bit, sliding poetry to the top row, placing the primary collaborations on a row of its own, and putting the secondary collaborations on the two bottom rows. To help keep track of that, I've also used a gradient of colors to denote genres, growing lighter the further away we get from a solo composition. Oh, and I got rid of the whole problem play category. Good riddance. The configuration works, though the table has lost some of its visual similarity to the shape of the true periodic table of elements. But that's okay. Also, some of the atomic numbers of the works are missing as I don't have those texts. Yet. When this project is done, I'll do some number crunching with the new Oxford editions, and we'll get a new version. But for now, there's a new and improved periodic table of Shakespeare. It's now available for purchase at teacherspayteachers.com, and t-shirt and poster versions are available for purchase at redbubble.com. And you can find those links in the left-hand navigation of this website. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entry since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Scholars and Geeks, Prepare to Enter the Lost Productivity Zone, Rest in Peace, Michael Bogdanov, Coriolanus, For the Love of Wounds, The New and Improved Periodic Table of Shakespeare Infographic, My Name is Caius Martius. Podcast 151, Interview Special, Melissa Charlesman, David Melville of the Independent Shakespeare Company, Part 3, Conclusion. Volumnia's Last Word, Economy-Sized. Coriolanus, A Sword Pull at the Point of No Return. Coriolanus by the Numbers. Coriolanus, The Fly in the Solo Ointment. And Coriolanus, The Wrap-Up. Now, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast, when we'll kick off Cymbeline with plot and intro. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 30th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.